From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, we review the failed attempt to reduce the state income tax.
I'm very grateful for the Republican legislators who voted no, recognizing that this would destabilize the entire budget process.
A researcher says instead of talking about race, we ought to be talking about skin color and bias.
Race is merely a proxy for skin color. Skin color we can define and we can measure.
Then a New York Times reporter visits a bit of Michigan transplanted to the Amazon jungle.
I've seen remnants of lost civilizations, and I've also come across ruins in different parts of Brazil, but I never saw something like this.
Plus, we talk to the maker of the world's best vodka.
It's amazing, isn't it? This little company in Ferndale is able to beat some of the biggest companies around the world.
But first, let's get a news update. Who knows what's happened in the last hour? Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for joining me on this last Friday of February. Coming up later in the hour, we'll speak with a New York Times reporter about his recent trip to the ruins of Henry Ford's Amazonian utopia. But first, initially, Michigan Republican legislators proposed phasing out the income tax altogether over the next 40 years. Then it was changed, reducing it from 4.25% to 3.9% in 4 years. This week, Michigan Speaker of the House Tom Leonard brought it up for a vote, and in the wee hours of the morning on Thursday, it failed. Joining me to talk about that are Joe Hoffman, a former Republican state representative who served as chair of the House Appropriations Committee, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Joe, this is being portrayed as an embarrassing failure by Speaker Leonard. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not sure we ought to be that tough on him yet. I think he knew that he potentially didn't have the votes and wanted to push the issue, wanted to show that the majority of his caucus was in favor of some kind of tax rollback. And it may be a temporary stumble, but, I give him credit for taking the chance on it.
Vicki, what do you think the chances are that this does not end the attempt to reduce the income tax for this year?
Well, I don't think it'll end the attempt. There's a similar bill that's in the Senate right now. I think there is a desire on the part of the Republican legislature to roll back the income tax. But this is also a sign of the governor getting a little stronger and saying, you know, we put in some tax breaks back in 2011. That's enough. We have things coming online, and my job is to run the state and make sure that we have a balanced budget going forward and a stronger economy. And I think he's going to stick to his guns, and I'm very grateful for the Republican legislators who voted no, recognizing that this would destabilize the entire budget process.
As been noted by several pundits, at the very least, Speaker Tom Leonard will be able to say the first thing he did as Speaker is try to lower taxes. How will that play if, as expected, he runs for Attorney General, Joe?
I know there's speculation that that's some of the motivation. I'm not sure that's completely true. Tom kind of denies that, if I read the reports correctly yesterday. And I think Vicki does raise a good point. You know, we've had other tax rollbacks. We had a significant change in the tax structure in 2010 when I took majority and Vicki and I started our second terms. And we've done some tweaking to the tax laws since then. And I think it's important to realize that, we've done some other targeted tax cuts. Although I think, Tom, I give him credit for saying, hey, after this many years of a prosperous state where we've balanced our budget on time or early, and we've got a budget surplus, we put money in our savings, and we've bought down pension debt, maybe it's time to give a little bit back to the taxpayer. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't necessarily agree that we need it year after year or a multi-year tax rollback, but we're in a pretty good condition right now, even with other liabilities coming, that the state's in much better shape than it used to be.
Vicki, how long do you think these good times are going to last?
Well, we're not really in good times. If you drive on our highways and roads and you recognize that Fraser and Southfield in Oakland County and Macomb County are struggling with huge sinkholes, you realize we've balanced the budget on the backs of the infrastructure and not taking care of the problems that we have that we know we see, not to mention the underground plumbing that we don't see. We've also cut back schools, Proposal A in 94, was designed to keep pace with school funding with inflation. It has not lived up to that obligation. And so we are, it looks like we're balancing our budget, and we are, but we've cut so many programs along the way and not truly lived up to our promises to our taxpayers that we've really hurt our entire state infrastructure and our public schools.
Let's move on to another topic. Yesterday, Governor Rick Snyder issued a news release indicating that the potential closing of 38 chronically underperforming schools is now being delayed. Joe, was that a surprise to you?
No. We were there when we talked about the 5% bottom 5% of the schools and that we need to hold them accountable and get them out of a perpetual failing. But certainly if you don't have a place to go with those students or you don't have a viable alternative, then you've got to reconsider it. So I think the governor made a good call.
Vicki, it looks as though the governor will now work with the State Board of Education before deciding the fates of these schools. What's that tell us?
Well, it tells us he's finally sitting down and reading the bills that we passed in 2009 and 10 that required the establishment of a school reform officer inside the Department of Education. The governor moved it to the Department of Technology Management and Budget, so there's been no coordination in the last year. The law also required that the school reform officer first place those schools with the school board's approval inside of the school reform officer's jurisdiction. That was not done, and then only after an attempt to use one of four methods to turn around those schools is the school reform officer allowed to, with proper due diligence, to close those schools. None of this has been done. There's a lawsuit now that's been filed by Kalamazoo School District and by Saginaw to hold our feet to the fire and to say a law was passed to deal with this, and you've not followed that law.
That's Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Also, we heard from Joe Hoffman, a former Republican state representative who served as chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Thanks very much, and I hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit is known worldwide for its cars, for its music, and now for its vodka. This video depicts Lenin's tomb. And as the camera slowly takes us into the monument where the body of Lenin lies in state in a glass coffin, we see a single tear escape from the corner of Lenin's eye.
The world's best vodka has been named, and it isn't from Russia. It's from Detroit. Valentine, named world's best vodka by the World Drinks Awards in London. Nazdorovia.
That led Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings and me to make a very good decision for this edition of Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
Well, not surprisingly, we are at a place where we can get a drink. Where are we today?
We are at Valentine Distilling Company, and not just at their tasting room in Ferndale. We're at their production facility, which I have to say is amazing.
And smells great.
So we're here with Heather today, and she's made a cocktail using Valentine's Old Tom Gin, and it's called the Bettina. What can you tell us about it, Heather?
It's a nice combination of a subtle sweet and citrus mix with a little herbal beet and rosemary edge to it as well.
So how do you make this drink?
We're going to combine 2 ounces of our barrel-aged gin. This is known as our Liberator, our Old Tom Gin. So we're combining that with about 3/4 ounces of a homemade beet and rosemary simple syrup. So this is just a combination of sugar and water in equal parts, typically hot water to melt down the sugar. And then we're combining it with beet juice and fresh rosemary. After that, we're going to add 3/4 ounce of fresh-pressed lemon juice for a little citrusy kick, and actually a couple droplets of saline. Saline is a salt and water combination. This takes down a little bit of the bitterness in the lemon juice and lets more of those aromatic elements come out. So what we're going to do is add this to a shaker, combine, shake vigorously with ice, and strain into a martini glass. You want to make sure you use a fine mesh strainer to remove all of the ice. And lastly, you're going to flame a fresh piece of rosemary just till we get a little bit of smoke curling off and drop that in as your garnish.
We'll have the recipe for that beet and rosemary syrup on our website, michiganradio.org.
I wanted to take a minute just to talk about those few drops of saline solutions she added. Almost any cocktail can be improved by a little bit of salt. It really helps to balance out sweet flavors, bitter flavors, and just add an extra layer of complexity. And I bet in this cocktail it's going to be a really great addition because it's going to bring out the savory qualities of the beet.
Well, we'll see you in a second.
Because now we're going to turn things over to Rufino Valentine, who's going to tell us a little more about Valentine Distilling Company.
Well, welcome. Welcome to Valentine. You are standing actually in one of the largest micro distilleries, not just in the Midwest, but in the country. We started this company with two main goals in mind. Number one, to show that some of the best products are still made in this country, in particularly Detroit. And number two, the end goal of corporations does not have to be solely about profit. We focus on quality, and we want to show that you can actually have both of those.
And to just what you said about world's best products, in fact, you were named world's best vodka last year. Congratulations for that.
Thank you so much. It's amazing, isn't it? This little company in Ferndale is able to beat some of the biggest companies around the world.
Now, we use gin in the drink that we're tasting today, but I think you're better known in Michigan anyway for your vodka.
Yeah, I mean, after you win a world championship, it's hard not to be. But we focus on all our products, and a lot of these international awards that we've won are actually for our gins.
A lot of micro distilleries get their start with vodka because it's easily produced and quick to come to market, but Valentine's really expanded and has a huge range now.
We have several different types of vodka, several different types of gins. We have a number of different types of bourbons, and most recent news, I would say, is this spring we're launching our rye whiskey.
Well, now you're talking to me. Okay, let's take a taste of the Bastina before the chill is off. Tammy, go ahead.
You can't see this on the radio, but it has a beautiful red color because of that beet. Oh, I love that. I'm a beet fan, so I have to admit that, but I think the beet flavor goes really well with this barrel-aged Old Tom style gin. Old Tom style gins sort of harken back to an earlier period in gin production. And so this has some of the caramel notes that you associate with a whiskey, but it has that juniper flavor that I love about gin. So this is a delicious cocktail. You should give it a try, Lester.
Well, I will tell you right now, I detest beets, really detest them. So I'm not sure how this is going to go. Okay. All right. Well, I don't get that beet flavor that I don't like in this. This is different. In fact, I had just a little sample of the gin before we mixed it, and that's the forward taste in my mind, and that's okay with me because I really liked it just straight out of the bottle.
It's a great cocktail. So thanks, Rufino, for having us, and thanks, Heather, for this delicious drink.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Cheers.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week marked 1 year since a mass shooting in Kalamazoo County. A part-time Uber driver, Jason Dalton, is facing charges. The shooting spree killed 6 people and seriously injured 2 others. One of the injured is teenager Abigail Kopp. Joining me right now is her father, Gene Kopp. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
How is Abigail doing?
Well, that's a very, very broad question. I mean, you know, when you've had a major injury like that, asking how she's doing is almost impossible to answer. She's had several surgeries, and she just had a plate put in to repair part of her missing skull.
Right. I was just reading that on your family's Facebook page that she underwent that replacement surgery earlier this month. How's she recovering from that?
So far, so good, but it's early. There's no guarantee, of course. She had that done earlier in the year, and an infection set in, and it had to be replaced. So hopefully all goes well, and that's all I can say.
I want to ask you kind of a difficult question, but would you remind us how severely Abigail was wounded?
She was shot in the head, and that meant in the brain. And that did shatter her skull and cause brain damage.
Abigail has had to spend most of her time at home, no school or other activities, because it would be dangerous for her injury. How's that affected her?
Well, you know, she was a gymnast. She climbed trees. She liked to swim, so she was active. And now she's locked up, practically. Although, hopefully, that'll open up a little bit. I don't foresee her ever being able to do gymnastics or climbing trees again, because the risk is, even though she has a plate, there's still too much risk. Maybe she'll get into swimming. I don't know. It's too early to say. We'll see what she decides to do once things settle down and go from there.
I also watched a video on Facebook of Abigail with her new pet pig, Snuffles. What has Snuffles meant to the family?
She has been a lot of fun for the whole family. She had a previous pig who was much larger and he had an injury to his legs, and he had to be put down because he could no longer walk. The Snuffles is a much, much smaller breed of pig. She missed her pig when he went down, so she begged for another one. And this has been her pet, keeps her company, and makes her happy. So,
and apparently likes Cheerios.
Yes, Cheerios are the great training aid, that and lettuce. Pigs eat anything, as we all know, and we've tried to keep it to something so she doesn't get overweight too easily. So we no kitchen scraps or anything like that.
You stayed away from the memorial service for the victims this week. Why?
Because we like our privacy. And obviously, I don't hold it against Michigan Radio, or I wouldn't be on here with you. But
and we appreciate that you're taking the time to talk to us.
But we all know that, unfortunately, there's a whole spectrum out there of journalists and so-called journalists, and not to mention just downright kooks who have nothing to do with the media. And unfortunately, when you're in the limelight, all of those appear. So we've had people in the public who have actually wanted, when Abby had her infection, wanted to touch her head with no skull and cast out the demons, and I'm not joking. We've had journalists three times follow my wife and Abby and tail them, like paparazzi, which is nerve-wracking, especially to gun violence victims. We had one incident where Abby and her mother were in the grocery store, and the man walked up and said that he was so proud to see Abby and wanted to show off the gun he got because of the incident. And, you know, he says, here he is showing off a pistol he's carrying around to a gun violence survivor who was shot by someone who was carrying around a pistol. What I don't know what he was thinking, but you know, that was definitely nerve-wracking. So there's a whole spectrum of people out there. We just want our privacy, and let's face it, she's a 15-year-old girl now, and most 15-year-old girls want their privacy. And when you're young, even with no injuries, you make lots of mistakes, and it's wonderful. Most of us have made mistakes in our youth, and the world didn't know about them, and life went on. And I certainly don't want her to go around life with everyone looking at her under a microscope, second-guessing everything she did, when most of us get the liberty of making mistakes, and the world doesn't know about it and doesn't hold it against us. So she needs that privacy.
Yeah, and as a father, I understand your need to help her protect herself from that. With what is hopefully the last major surgery behind her, what's next for Abigail and your family?
We don't know. It's hard to say. I guess the problem that the question leads to is people want to know what's her prognosis. And the answer is that's uncharted territory, so no one can give a prognosis.
Right.
So we can't give an answer of where things are going. And likewise, the family, I don't know. The whole lesson of this is don't try to plan too much because, to paraphrase Woody Allen, if you want to make fate laugh, tell her your plans. And that's definitely the case here.
Mr. Kopp, I really appreciate that you took the time to talk to us. I wish your family peace and the privacy you're seeking, and we all hope the very best recovery for Abigail.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are a lot of ideas about how to improve schools out in the ether. A new book tackles the issue of leadership in schools. The book is Truth Transforms Education, Framework for New School Leaders. The author is Antoinette Pearson. Dr. Pearson, the title, Truth Transforms Education. Explain that for us.
When we tend to think about how we want to transform and restructure educational systems and schools, we really need to think about what is the truth, what's the reality. And sometimes the decisions that are being made are perceptions of truth or individual or groups' idea of what truth is and what's best for schools, when in reality we need to actually step into the schools, we need to talk to the people who are boots on the ground and get an understanding of what's actually happening and then base our decisions on there. So if we tackle the issues by looking at and talking to the people who are impacted and who are making the change or should be making the change, then I think we can drill down to the root causes, which is what Truth will do, transform education.
I want to talk about a couple of the leadership, types of leadership that you talked about in the book. You said you could be a transactional leader or transformational leader. What do you mean by that? What are you telling your readers?
Right. So when you do some research on leadership, you will come across transformational leadership. You also come across transactional leadership. And essentially, transactional leadership is a leader doing something or leading people in exchange for something else, people following them for in exchange for something else. So higher pay or, you know, position, power, that kind of thing. So they're indeed doing something to receive something back. Transformational leadership talks about and really focuses on that leader and how they motivate, so that charismatic, the one who really is excited and engaging of the staff. But the problem with that is that after a while, that can burn out that leadership because they're just too hyped all the time and really are just doing things and people are following them because of the person. Whereas the other leadership, which I really focus a lot on, servant leadership, really talks about how you can build the capacity in people.
Now, that's servant leadership.
Yes, servant leadership.
So, yeah, you talked about that quite a bit in
the book. Yes, I did. So servant leadership is different in the fact that it focuses on the people that you are leading and how you can build those people, how you can invest in their skill set, how you can help them take that skill set and move towards the goals of the organization. So it's not dependent on one person. It really is a collaborative effort, and it causes individuals to buy into who they are as people and why they decided their purpose, why they decided to become a teacher or an educator. And then that essentially is what motivates them to move forward. Not the person, not because of they're going to get something in exchange, but because they believe in who they are and their purpose for doing the work. And remember why they're there, that when we're talking about schools, it's all about the kids and how we're serving them. And so if that means that I have to tap on the shoulder of these teachers because they know a little bit more about the topic than I do, then absolutely. And that says nothing about you as a leader in terms of being weak. It actually shows your strength because you're able to admit your inadequacies, realize that this work can't be done by one person alone.
Now, you've been in education in schools for a couple of decades. You begin the book describing your first job as a principal.
Yes.
What did you walk into at this school, and what did you learn from the experience?
Right. So my first experience, I actually was assigned to one school, and then I got a phone call, you know, saying that, hey, we're going to move you to another school. My first school did a walkthrough. Everything was looking great, and, you know, saw the nice posters and the tidy classrooms, and, you know, just really got excited
about a happy principal,
right?
Yeah.
Really got excited about what was going to happen. Then I got the phone call and said, hey, we're going to switch you for whatever reason, don't know. And so I said, well, let me make this walkthrough to see what it was. And when I pulled up, immediately I was a little disturbed because the grass was growing high, and I said, okay, is this building vacant? Is it closed? You know, has someone occupied it in the past year? So I said, okay, never mind. We'll look past that. But going into the building, I really had a culture shock because it was completely different than that first building I walked into. The walls were dingy. You know, paint was coming off. I walked into the restrooms. There was black paint all over the place. There was graffiti on signs throughout the building and on the mirrors in the restrooms. And then when you go into the main office, there was just clutter everywhere and papers posted all over the glass wall of the office. And, you know, as I went to each classroom and looked in, there was mismatched books, different places, mismatched furniture. Cafeteria had food stains from where they had food fights. And so after I did this walkthrough, I walked to my car and I literally cried. And I said, am I being punished for something? You know, how can I go from a school that I was excited about to now this school that didn't look as if it had been kept up in several years? And so I had to make a decision then. Either I was going to say, this is not for me, this is going to be too hard to turn around and let the powers that be know, hey, I don't want it. But then that could potentially set me up for not receiving additional principalships in the future. Or I could make the decision to say, listen, this is what I've been given. I have to make the best of the situation, and I'm going to make it work. And that's what I decided to do.
And as the book explains, pretty much solo. You didn't have a lot of help. You didn't But I want to get to that other question. What did you learn from that experience? What did it teach you?
Right. So from that experience, and this is going through the system from a teacher, you know, from being a sub to a teacher, just being in the K-12 system, I knew working with students and with parents they have to feel as if the school is a place of learning. It has to look bright and inviting, and it has to feel safe. And so my number one thing was to make the school look like a school and not like a prison, because that's what it looked like to me. It was just drab and it was unkept. And so that was my number one priority. And so in any situation that I go into as a leader, I have to make it feel like a school. So that's one of the lessons that I learned. The other thing was I had to learn how to prioritize and find quick wins with no real support, no mentor. I had to decide what was going to be best for the students at that time to change things around. And so I knew that I had to put some systems in place that was going to cause the students to see that this was going to be a new sheriff in town, that we were going to do some things a little different and communicating that with them openly. So my first couple of months, it was really a struggle because the kids weren't used to that kind of structure, as was evident by the way the building was looking. But once they understood why we were doing what we were doing and having the conversation with the teachers, the students' idea of schooling began to shift as well. And so I knew that second lesson is that clearly communicating with people the purpose for why you're there and what you're doing goes a long way. Most times we do things and we don't necessarily tell people why we're doing it. And that helped me communicate with the students and the staff. So communicating clearly and having clear goals.
You write that we can never really address some of these failing schools until we address the issue of poverty.
Absolutely.
How do we do that? There's no money.
There is no money, so we say. But one thing that I know is that poverty is real. And the poverty that impacts our children is it causes them not to be able to be ready to receive the education or the learning that we as teachers and educators want them to have. A student is going to find it very difficult to concentrate when they're hungry or they haven't had sleep, or they don't know where they're going to sleep the next day. And so it's almost as if they're traumatized. And so we expect them to sit down and to learn and engage when they're just trying to survive. And so we as a city, as community, as businesses, we have to find a way to rally behind school districts to provide that social emotional support, to begin to improve our communities, our neighborhoods, so that our children can get the benefit of it. You know, it's hard for a parent who's trying to make ends meet to really help focus on, you know, educating their student at home when they're just trying to work to pay the bills. And so we have to understand that this is a reality and it's a part of how we're going to change schools. You can't ignore poverty and expect to transform schools. So in order for us to do that, again, we have to, you know, sit down as groups, stakeholders who are vested in education. We need to see what it is that each can bring to the table so that we can begin to address the poverty issue, because schools can't do it by themselves. A teacher can't be the counselor and the social worker and, you know, the human health services department. They can't do all of those things by themselves.
But right now, with the political climate as it is in the state and in the nation, you're not going to see that kind of help increase. So you worked in Detroit Public Schools. The legislature and the governor did a big restructuring of debt for the Detroit Public Schools. There's no doubt that it helped, but there are still failing schools, struggling schools. What will it take to fix Detroit Public Schools if we're not going to see a lot more money?
I think we need to first really take a laser look at how we are allocating our current expenditures and make sure that those expenditures are aligned to the goals that we have indeed set. Sometimes we have spending of programs or personnel, and they don't really align to what it is we said we want to do as a district or as a community or as a city. And so really, you know, taking a look at all of the things that we are purchasing or financing and asking that big question, is this going to benefit, you know, our students academically? And if not, where do we need to move those resources? And sometimes when if we decide to take a look, and I mean really look at it and not worry about how adults are going to feel if this program is cut or if this position is cut, we really look at, we'll see we're duplicating services as well. And so I think we really need to sit down, look to see where we can redistribute some funding. We definitely have a lot of philanthropic business partners who want to help schools. And so they want to make sure that their investment is truly going towards the classroom and to the students. And so we need to be able to show on our end what it is that we're doing, how we're currently spending our money, and then we can get the additional support. But for me, it's not always about the money. It's how you're using the money. And then not only that, the people you've put in charge of educating students, making sure they've gotten all the training that they need. And that's something that I mentioned in our book. School leaders have to really invest in those people who are in front of those children. Those are the most important people in the building, the teachers and the leaders. And so are we really giving them the support they need in terms of training? You know, and I'm getting on my soapbox, but we can't just beat down teachers and building leaders for decades of things that have happened and now have compounded into this one massive problem and expect for them to fix it on their own when in actuality they didn't create the problem on their own. So it needs to be an effort that includes everyone, and it's going to take time. And I think sometimes we don't realize how much time it takes, and we're quick to want to pass judgment if something doesn't work within 6 months or a year and say that it's failing, when in actuality research says it takes 3 to 5 years for things to really change.
Antoinette Pearson is the author of Truth Transforms Education, A Framework for New School Leaders. Thanks for coming in and talk with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've had conversations on this program about race and racial tensions many times, but one scholar says we've got it all wrong. We shouldn't be talking about race because that's relatively meaningless. He wants to shift the conversation about bias from race to skin color. Ron Hall is a professor of social work at Michigan State University. So tell us, how is race different from skin color?
Well, race is merely a proxy for skin color. Skin color we can define and we can measure. Race is just a political and social construct that we've used since the antebellum. More and more as we get closer to the next century, past this recent millennium, we're going to come to a time when you won't be able to look at individuals and differentiate their so-called race based on their hair texture, eye color, skin colors, etc., as I think racial miscegenation indeed will be the norm at that point.
So let's talk about this idea of skin color can be measured. I mean, you know, you're talking about gradations, and a person of Asian Indian background or African background may have similar skin tone, but they're not treated the same, at least in this society.
No. The skin tone of African Americans varies, and we're talking about the amount of melanin that an individual has. And what I'm trying to inform people about when I talk about the issue of skin color, it's more than just racism. When we discriminate on the basis of how much melanin an individual has in their skin. So an Indian Asian will be similarly discriminated against if they're dark-complected as a dark-complected African-American. And in fact, Indian Asians amongst their own population will suffer from various forms of skin color discrimination. And that's an extension of the caste system, which goes back thousands of years. And in fact, the term caste comes from the Portuguese casa, and casa means breed, like an animal.
In your article published by The Conversation, you talk about skin color being an issue within the African-American community. How does that play out?
That has been going on since the antebellum period. Of course, you had some individuals who were the offspring of the propertied class, the master class. And those individuals were oftentimes educated, oftentimes lived a better standard of living, and oftentimes they were more intellectually gifted because of the education that some of them got. As a matter of fact, if you go back to the early years during the antebellum in Louisiana, there were some African-descended individuals who were quote-unquote mixed race who might even be educated at the Sorbonne in Paris. And if you look at the leadership early on, many of your intellectuals of W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trotter, were mixed-race individuals. They were committed to the black community, but as Du Bois called them, the talented 10th, they were a little more advantaged because of they were the offspring of the master class.
Let's talk about the conversations today among people in the black community, because, you know, we've seen it in different situations on TV and documentaries where the darker you are, sometimes that is a status in itself because those who are more light-skinned aren't black enough.
Yes.
And then there are people who are very light-skinned who are considered to be I don't know how to put it, but they're somehow better just because they have lighter skin. So tell me how that works out today.
Today is nothing more than extension of the past, and I'm sorry to say it may even be intensified because the level of interracial marriages, the level of miscegenation stands to only increase. Now, I've done studies, and there are other individuals who have done studies where I've correlated income, education, and occupation with skin color. And that's regardless of what your ethnic group is. If I talk about Indian Asians, African Americans, and Latinos, the lighter complected you are, the less threatening you are to mainstream society. Therefore, you're likely to earn more money, get better jobs, and likely to aspire to a higher rate of education. Now, I use President Obama as an example, not to suggest that he was able to become president because he was lighter complected, but I'm suggesting that because of his lighter complexion, there are obstacles that he did not have to overcome had he been a darker complected individual. And that crosses racial lines, it crosses ethnic and cultural lines.
So is this just simply learned behavior? Are we hardwired somehow to see, and you'll have to excuse the terms, but white is better, dark is not? How do we keep arriving at this conclusion?
Well, a lot of it doesn't get talked about in an economic context, but it's really economic. If you go back to the 1400s, sometime prior to the Atlantic slave trade, status was not contingent upon race. As a matter of fact, the concept didn't even exist. Status was contingent upon your culture or religious background. And after the slave trade, we had to find a way to separate slaves from slave masters. So we created this identity around white. As a matter of fact, there's a Princeton history professor by the name of Nell Painter. She's written one of the most interesting books that I've ever read in my life called The History of White People. And when I picked it up and I began reading it, the most salient point in the book that she talks about whites and blacks, when they initially arrived here in this what was to become the U.S., got along fine. Then individuals were Dutch, they were Irish, they were French. Those working class Dutch, Irish, and French got along well with African Americans, Latinos, and other people of color. You had a 2% wealthy Euro-Americans who were being raided and robbed by this common class of individuals. And they had to find a way to get the poorer Europeans to identify with the wealthy Europeans, who they otherwise wanted nothing to do with. And they convinced them that they're not Irish or British or Dutch, but that they're white. And they gave them a few more advantages, privileges. They could testify in court. They might be able to carry weapons, which non-Europeans couldn't do. And from that point, you see poor Euro-Americans, individuals who might reside in Appalachia, for example, should support the policies of someone like President Obama vis-a-vis health care. But they typically define their political leanings in a racial context. So you have always had a wealthy class of individuals who are exploiting the rest of the poor classes, common man, for racial reasons to sustain themselves. And until we get the economics out of race, unfortunately, I hate to say, it's probably always going to be with us.
You're something of an outlier. I mean, most scholars who talk about ethnicity talk about race. When they talk about things like racial profiling and so forth, how much traction are you getting among your colleagues in arguing, forget about race, let's talk about skin color?
I'm getting a lot more than I had anticipated, but you have to bear in mind that I've been writing about this issue and studying it for, if you count my dissertation work, 25, 30 years. I testified as an expert witness in the nation's first case of skin color discrimination, Morrill versus the Internal Revenue Service, which involved a light-skinned and a dark-skinned African-American. 10 years prior, in 1980, you had a similar case involving Latinos. That's Felix versus Manquez. Since that case, or those two cases, there had literally been hundreds of cases filed on the basis of not racial discrimination, but skin color discrimination. This has always been an issue, but As I subtitle my first book, The Color Complex, The Last Taboo Among African Americans, it's something that people are not comfortable talking about in public discourse. And as a behavioral scientist, I have to go where the facts lead me. So some people are going to be upset about it, and that's unfortunate.
Bottom line this for us. What does society, and I'm talking about U.S. society, gain in shifting the conversation from race to skin color?
My biggest point in that shift, it's much less polarizing. Regardless of where I speak, where I might lecture, typically, unless they're an unusual audience, most Euro-Americans, when they talk about the subject of race or someone's going to lecture on race or racism, they've heard it all before. And so you kind of get this shutdown. You begin to talk past people rather than to people. But when I talk about skin color, in fact, it is possible for a person of European descent to be discriminated against on the basis of complexion. For example, if you are a very dark-complected Greek or Italian, you may suffer similar forms of discrimination. So we're not talking about divisions by race. We're talking about divisions by humanity. And I think it's much less threatening to talk about it in that fashion. Secondly, as I mentioned a little earlier, I can quantify skin color. I can measure the amount of melanin, which is that ingredient that gives us our color. I can measure that. So it's much more amenable to science and less amenable to our bias.
Ronald Hall is a professor of social work at Michigan State University. His article is titled, Who Counts as Black? You can find it at theconversation.com. Professor Hall, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, and I hope you can contact me at the Skin Color Doctor.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. In the 1920s, the demand for rubber went way up. With more cars being made, the auto manufacturers needed rubber for tires, hoses, and so on. Henry Ford decided he'd go right to the source for his rubber. In 1928, he planned a rubber tree plantation in what essentially was a model Midwestern town along the Amazon River in Brazil. He called it Fordlandia. Simon Romero is Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times, and he recently visited Fordlandia, or what's left of it, and he wrote about it this week. So what did you find when you finally got the chance to visit Fordlandia?
Fordlandia was really one of the most incredible places I've ever been in Brazil. I'd been to the Amazon numerous times before. I've explored parts of various river basins up there. I've seen remnants of lost civilizations. And I've also come across ruins in different parts of Brazil, but I never saw something like this, which was really this American-style Midwestern town that Henry Ford had built in the 1920s on the banks of the Tapajós River. And the first thing that you see is this huge water tower when you arrive by riverboat from the city of Santarém. It takes 6 hours to get there upriver. And there's a huge warehouse that's been abandoned that has words painted on it that read, Welcome to Fordlandia. It's really incredible because you actually have around 2,000 people now living in the town, some of whom live in the ruins that were abandoned by the Americans at the end of World War II. So it really is just a fascinating place.
So we're talking about this town had sidewalks, street lamps, a hospital, bungalows, which you wrote were still being used, still being lived in. Trying to build a Midwestern town in the jungle seems like a pretty naive thing to do, considering nature has a way of reclaiming what's taken. How'd that work out for Ford and his people?
Well, it was plagued by problems from the start. They had to recruit workers from around Brazil to work at the rubber plantation outside of the town. And Henry Ford had a certain idea of what type of values should be hewed to in the town that he was building. He promoted, for example, readings of poetry that was translated into Portuguese, poems by Longfellow and Emerson. He really disliked music like jazz that was emerging strongly in the 1920s and 30s and had the workers do square dancing. And they had to also stick to a diet that he set for them of canned peaches and browned rice and food like that. They also had their working lives tightly controlled by managers. And all of this blew up at one point into a full-scale riot in 1930. and workers in the town destroyed much of it. They destroyed time clocks, they cut electricity to the plantation, and they actually drove some of the American managers into the jungle. They had to flee for their lives. So it was a place that had lots of problems. Nevertheless, you know, Ford advanced with his project and had the place built. It was really quite stunning. It had, you know, asphalted roads and a working sewage system and even a hospital built by Albert Kahn, the incredible architect who designed many buildings in 20th century Detroit. Sadly, some of those buildings are in ruins, including the hospital built by Kahn, which I explored, and it's just really a tragedy to see it in that state.
Now, the whole purpose, harvesting rubber, raising these trees, also seems to have been handled badly. Tell us about that.
Well, Ford was extremely skeptical of relying on the advice of experts, including agronomists, who could have counseled him and his managers on strategies to grow rubber trees properly in the jungle. Of course, you know, the rubber tree is native to the Brazilian Amazon, but seeds were taken outside of Brazil in the 1870s, giving birth to rubber plantations around Asia in places like Malaysia and Indonesia and Sri Lanka. That devastated Brazil's rubber industry, but those plantations became very successful. And Ford thought that he would have a fairly easy time replicating that success on an industrial scale in the Brazilian Amazon. And it was really the opposite that happened. They planted trees too close to one another, making for a perfect environment for leaf blight to take place. It was a paradise for the insects that preyed on rubber trees. So it was really just plagued by one problem after another. Eventually, they did bring in expert advice, but it was really too late. By the time the 1940s came around, they realized that their operations would never be profitable, and they sold the entire venture at a huge loss to the Brazilian government in 1945.
So that's when Ford pulled out of Fordlandia. The people that are living in Fordlandia now, you said there are about 2,000 folks. What's life like there?
You know, it's incredibly relaxed, actually. It's a small town. You know, you have people, ironically, not getting around in cars in a town that was founded by Henry Ford, but largely on motorbikes and bicycles or just walking around. It's quite poor. You know, people survive either on government subsidies that are provided to the poor in Brazil, or they farm small plots of land, crops like manioc, where rubber trees once grew, or they graze, you know, tropical cattle on small parcels of land. So they're really just scraping by. The town did have a placid feel to it. People are extremely friendly. They're welcoming. People welcomed me into their homes, including squatters who have moved into the homes on what was once called Palm Avenue, this sort of stately thoroughfare where the management once lived. And those homes were falling apart and were being preyed upon by looters. And so you had several families of squatters who have moved in and essentially salvaged those homes, making them very pleasant places to live in. And they welcomed me inside and gave me interviews. It's really a very pleasant place, I would say.
I'm wondering what you think the lesson to be learned is from Fordlandia.
Well, not only was Ford skeptical of relying on agronomists for expertise, but he was also extremely skeptical of history. At one point, he actually told the New York Times in an interview in 1921 that history is bunk. Those were his exact words. And he was really in favor of sort of barreling ahead and very sure of his own plans. The Amazon, however, is a place that tends to be extremely complex for these large-scale developments that have really failed to take off time and again. So if he had perhaps relied on the advice of historians as well, he could have learned about the pitfalls, the challenges involved in operating in the world's largest tropical forest. And trust me, there are many.
Simon Romero reports for the New York Times. The article is titled "Deep in Brazil's Amazon, Exploring the Ruins of Ford's Fantasy Land." Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who told the director, "Don't bother me. I'm listening to the interview." Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.